Are you ready, Alabama?
Hello? Who's there? What's going on?
You're listening to our number two in the doghouse.
Whatever's happening here, just knock it off.
Call the big dog now at 866-485-9867.
These kids are weird, man. They're weird.
Live from the Big Dog Production Studios.
How you doing?
It's the Tom Abraham Show.
That might be listed in Revelations as the cause for the apocalypse.
Here he is, the head of the household, the Big Dog.
You're the smartest guy I've ever met.
Tom Abraham.
You want me to do this crap?
I guess I'm on here. Am I on? Can somebody respond?
And welcome back, hour number two. Tom Abraham Show. Joining us now, talk a little Braves coming off of a win. They kind of stole one, didn't they, from the Rockies. Rockies, very good baseball team. Going to beat a wild card, one of the two wild card teams, most likely with Arizona in the National League. But the Braves get one out there yesterday, and, of course, they'll go again tonight. And then tomorrow during the show, joining us now, a guy does a tremendous job at TomahawkTake.com, Alan Carpenter. Carp, welcome in. How are you, man?
We are doing very well. Thank you. Great, glad to be here.
All right, before we get to what's going on today, let's go back to 74 because apparently they're wearing these uniforms over the weekend to honor Hank Aaron becoming the all-time home run king in 1974, which is fine in terms of honoring him, and it wasn't the worst team that they ever had in that gear because that was actually a pretty decent year for the Braves. But what are your thoughts on it? What jumps to mind when you see – the as I call them, the pajama Braves gear from the mid-70s.
Well, let me throw this in first because I'm just going to mention how wonderful this is, even as we've got fights among people across the country about Confederate monuments, racial division here and there. The Atlanta Braves, the city of Atlanta, and fans all over Braves country continue to stop and consistently honor Hank Aaron while he's still with us. Yeah. For what he's meant to all of us in the sporting community around for his outstanding career. I mean, this is where sports brings us all together, and I just don't know that enough is said about that, and right. I'm glad to see it continue to be done.
Now, that's now, a stop the right uniforms. There because I think we have to put that in perspective because how old were you in 74 when he broke the record? I was 13 years old. I mean, how old were you?
I was 12, so
remember.
I grew up with.
Yeah, you remember, and of course, I was a Yankee fan, and that didn't matter. Didn't have anything to do with that. I don't think people now maybe realize how big a deal this was. We were only 6-7 years removed from some real, civil rights, social unrest in the South, and to have a black man in Georgia breaking Babe Ruth's record. This was a really, really big deal. It was a lot of hate from a lot of people and so on. And, and thankfully nothing bad happened. It was an absolutely ridiculous thing. I didn't understand it myself at that age, being 13 years old, even I didn't understand what the big issue was. But this was a monumental thing that this was happening, that he was that a black man in Georgia was about to become the all-time home run king, and he was times where he feared for his life.
Yeah, but same time you go back and look at the videos of that event, and that stadium was full. It was packed out. Yeah. People were cheering like crazy when that happened. It was a moment to be held that should go down in history to remember. As you could say, this turned the tide in the civil rights era in certainly Atlanta, at least, and I think it continued to spread among the South after that.
Well, and there's a famous picture of the two people that come out. I mean, man, can you imagine? He's running the bases. This could never happen now. He's running the bases, and two guys come out on the field to shake his hand between second and third base. they're white guys, you know, and they're like patting him on the back and shaking his hand and everything else. And they meant no ill towards him. But, man, you wonder what must have been going through his mind at that point in time when those two guys came out of the stands.
Yeah, I think it was something like he's been asked about that, of course, several times. It was kind of like, well, okay, I'll just keep running.
Yeah,
they weren't. It's like, I don't understand it, but I'm going to keep going.
Yeah, that's a good point. All right, so to the gear. Now, let's just put it in perspective, because my overall impression when I think of that gear, I just think of horrific teams. I think of Bob Horner for some reason. I don't know. Bob Horner pops into my head. But that year, they really weren't bad. They finished third in the National League West. There was behind Los Angeles and Cincinnati. They were 14 games back of Los Angeles, but they did win 88 games. I think they were 88 and 74 or something like that season. So they weren't like an awful baseball team. Hell, 88 wins this year gets you in a wild card if you're in the American League.
Yeah, it wasn't a great team, but they had a decent offense. It was a team right around that era that was the first and still only, I think, to have four different teammates hit 40 home runs in the same year. I want to say that happened in 72 or 73, where that came together. But, I mean, still, they had some offense going. Darrell Evans was actually their leading hitter at that point. But the pitching just didn't hold together. The defense was a little iffy here and there. And it was just exemplified the way the Braves had been playing since they ran up against the amazing Mets in 1969, where they had their best team of that era.
Yeah, because the next year, remember now, at the end of that year, after Hank Aaron broke the record, he was then traded to the Milwaukee Brewers. Now, he started in Milwaukee with the Braves, the Milwaukee Braves, and this is when the Milwaukee Brewers were in the American League, so he could be a DH. The new DH had just come about at that particular point in time, so he was able to extend his career a little bit and take the record a little bit further there. But in 75, they were a disaster. They were 67 wins. They were 40 and a half games back of the Big Red Machine that year at the end of the season. I mean, they were just, it just all fell apart in 75.
And right after that's when Ted Turner took over, and I think he bought it the team in 1976 and made official in the next year. But he took the team and started spending money, and then the rest is history.
Yeah. All right. So to the gear, do you look at that gear with nostalgia and you say, oh, that's just beautiful? Or do you look at that gear and say, oh, my God? You know, because to me, some throwbacks should just be thrown back. You know what I mean? I mean, they just I don't want to ever see them again. But what's your thought when you see those gear, especially in light of today's gear and when they wear the throwback gear to before that gear, the gear they wore in the 60s and when they first came from Milwaukee?
Well, the Braves have had a similar uniform since way back in the day when they first became the Braves in the early 1900s. So they maintained the look, kind of like the Yankees have. They've been sticky with that classic thing. So this was essentially a violent departure in terms of color and style and logos and everything. They went the whole nine yards with it. I do like the colors because I like the contrast. And those color schemes, I think, were kind of played up when Turner bought the team and put them on his superstation and became America's team. They had the red, white, and blue look. My biggest complaint is essentially utilitarian. I would prefer a button-up jersey instead of a pullover, which is what these were. But I got to say, if you've seen my Twitter avatar, you know that I like them because I borrowed from it to use that as a logo. So, yeah, I like the color contrast. I like the bright colors. It does have a little bit of a softball feel to it, I admit, but this is classic early 70s, and it just works for me, I think. And I like to see them bring it back. I did not approve of their baby blue road uniforms when they used that combination, because that did not give us as much a contrast to the colors, and it was hard to see what was going on with those uniforms. But I do like the white against the blue and the red that we're going to see this weekend in the home uniforms.
Well, that was a era that we went through in baseball where we had those powder blues. Everybody wore those powder blues on the road. They started to, at least the Cardinals wore them, the Royals wore them, Milwaukee wore them. I mean, a lot of teams were wearing them, and the Braves had them. My problems with the thing are just so many. First of all, it looks like a softball uniform, and I don't mind color tops, But I'm with you on button up. Like, I much prefer the Oakland A's green and yellow tops that they wear now compared to the ones they wore in the 70s that were pullovers. All of these pullovers, yes, I didn't like them. Secondly, this uniform is not going to be worn nearly as well as they wore it back then, because they wore it more snug. The socks were uniform. The pants were, you know, all the same. Everybody wore their pants all the same height. This is going to look weird because it's not going to look like how they wore it then. You know what I mean? It's going to be sloppy the way they wear the uniforms now.
It's a better combination, a better look this time around than whatever they did with the material and such at the time.
No tomahawk bothers the hell out of me. I mean, the tomahawk is the key element to the jersey for the Braves. There's no tomahawk to be found in this gear. It's a different blue. It's more blue than any other Braves uniform. The Braves has always had, you know, of course, now they wear that dark blue top with the blue numbers that I hate on the road sometimes. But their normal home uniforms have a lot of red in them with just some blue trim. And honest to goodness, forever I could not figure out as a kid what the hell that thing was on the sleeve. I thought it was a rose. I really thought it was a rose, and it's a bad feather is what it is, but I thought it was a rose. So I don't like it. I mean, I like what they wear now, and I like the cream that they wear, and I really do like the red. You know, when they used to wear the red back on Sundays, you know, that red look did not bother me at all. I just, this one here, and the other part is it's all I can think of is bad baseball. I don't think they were ever a playoff team in that gear. Were they?
Yeah, I admit I like the red tops as well. That's not a very popular opinion among a lot in Braves country, I admit, but I did like the red top. Now, if we could conjure up a way to get a tomahawk on this color scheme, how would you feel about it then?
Well, it would help, but it would be just a bastard. I just think their uniform is classic. See, like the Yankees, I think it's a classic uniform. I just think it's a uniform. Why would you throw back to something that was a worse uniform? Like the Packers do this all the time. The Packers will wear their throwback gear, and I hate watching them that week because it's like you don't even look like you look like crap. Yeah, you got one of the best uniforms in the league, if not the best, and then you're going to wear some garbage. The Braves have a classic, classic look. I don't want to see the Houston Astros wearing the sun is rising uniforms, you know, from the 70s. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to see the Braves wearing their uniforms from the 70s. I mean, I think that's the thing. It's more about how much I like their current uniform than how much you don't like the other one.
Well, if you want really bad throwbacks, got to go look at the Rays and the Indians from a couple days ago. They had just a bizarre thing. The Indians were using this all red thing that they used a couple of years, and then the Rays had some sort of a dusty blue with like a yellow chartreuse almost kind of lettering. It was just hideous. But that's the reason I guess I like the Braves combinations coming up this week, is because the colors do pop and they do jump up and say hi to you, because I do like that. But you're right, it is complete departure from what the classic Braves uniform look like, and if that's going to bug you, then it's not going to go well, I'm afraid. Sorry.
Yeah. All right. Alan Carpenter with us, TomahawkTake.com. All right. What's going on with him now? What's going on with Dansby Swanson? Because he was doing something good, and then is he hurt? What happened?
I don't know that he got hurt. He's actually been finally hitting well lately. He's been once he got called back up, he was hitting line drives, but hitting them right at people. He's gotten several hits the last couple of days. Yesterday, he got a big double that drove in two runs. So I think there's encouraging signs there, it seems. But we just got to see if he can keep it up. I'm hoping for the best, but we've got to see a lot more than just a week of play out of it.
Yeah. All right, give us some other Braves news. What we're going to see here as they continue on, taking a look at more and more of the young guys.
I think so, although it's going to be interesting with a 40-man roster. The one problem that the Braves have with a deep farm system is the fact that they're going to have to protect too many people, probably, for the Rule 5 draft coming up this winter. So that's going to mean that every 40-man spot is fairly needful to have around. That said, there are signs and there are hints that Ronald Acuna may be making an appearance sometime in September when the minor league season's finished. He has just been too good for too long and continues to do better at every promotion site he's given this year. He started this year two levels below in Florida. and was promoted to Mississippi. He got better. He was promoted to AAA Gwinnett. He's gotten better. I don't see how they can keep from bringing him up and giving us a taste of what we might be able to see in the near future, probably in the starting outfield next spring. So I'm looking forward to him in particular. We may see some other guys like Chris Bedlin, depending on whether there's anybody else traded for pitchers. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be too many, but I think Acuña is going to be the one to watch for.
Yeah. All right, and this MC Hammer concert that's going to take place at SunTrust Park on Saturday night, is this because of, his nickname, the Hammer nickname, was he actually got that, I think, because people used to think he looked like Hank Aaron, a young Hank Aaron, and that's where he got the Hammer nickname. But is it related to this whole 70s-type theme, or was it just a coincidence that MC Hammer was performing the same weekend that they're honoring Hank Aaron?
I think they picked him up because he has, in fact, declared that he uses the Hammer name based on Hank Aaron, and yeah. He's a big fan of the Braves. He apparently grew up working in baseball clubhouses and got his start and got discovered because he was singing a bit here and there in the clubhouse. He's certainly a baseball fan through and through, and I think the Braves had rightly decided to capitalize on the connection, and I think it's going to work very well for them, and I appreciate them catching up or taking up that subtlety and exploiting it.
Yeah, actually, I'm reading now. It says that he actually was a bat boy for the Oakland A's in his home of Oakland where he grew up, and it says here that he entertained fans by dancing during breaks in the game and earned the nickname Hammer for his resemblance to the true all-time home run leader, Hammer and Hank Aaron. Wow, that's at the Braves website. They referred to that's some serious shade thrown at Barry Bonds. You won't hear Hank say that. I mean, he won't necessarily. Hank doesn't say I'm the true home run champion. But that's it's interesting to see, at the official website of the team for them to throw that kind of shade at Barry Bonds.
He is, you're right. We just passed the 10-year anniversary. I can't believe it's been that long. When Barry Bonds did hit the home run that eclipsed Hank Aaron 756, I'll say. Yeah. And there were some write-ups both sides to try and figure out, hey, are we going to forgive Barry Bonds? Are we going to forget this? Are we going to embrace him? My thought is no. At this point in our history and society, we are continuing to try and eradicate cheating in sports and performance enhancement. And baseball has certainly been the leader in sports in trying to get performance enhancing drugs out of the sport. So if you want to embrace a guy who's the poster child of steroids in the sport, then I think you do a great disservice to everything you're trying to do to get the thing out of to get that out of sports. And you essentially say, by enshrining him in Cooperstown or any place else, if you're going to do drugs, then you're going to be rewarded. I think that's mm-hmm. a bad precedent to set. I think it continues to be a bad precedent, and I'd like to see that baseball continue to effectively shun Barry Bonds for his accomplishments, because he essentially did not do it the right way, as we say.
Well, when Giancarlo Stanton hit his 44th last night, he's on a low 60s home run pace right now. And I find myself being really energized by seeing if this guy can hit 62. It's weird. It's like I'm not even thinking about 74. I'm just thinking that about that 62. And we, of course, since they supposedly eradicated some sort of PEDs out, I still think there's something going on at various times. And I also think that the ball is juiced, to be honest with you. But I think 62 would mean something, and it's going to be very interesting to see how baseball and baseball fan will handle Giancarlo Stanton if he gets to that last weekend and he's sitting on 60 or something like that. Will we feel like 62 means something again because it's been 10 or 12 years since that went down?
That's a real good question. I would tend to think that it would be meaningful, particularly in light of what we've learned since that those home run chases with Sammy Sosa, Mark McGwire, and Bonds in the last decade there. I will say also there's some news today that the Marlins may listen on Giancarlo Stanton if there's any team out there that would like to try and figure out how to do a trade for him. Boy, I'd love to see an outfield of Stanton, Acuna, and Enciarte roaming the outfield for the Braves for another decade or so. But there's a lot of crazy reasons for doing that and a lot of crazy reasons not to. So just a little throw out there, a little fantasy there.
Yeah. All right, man. Appreciate you as always. Alan Carpenter joining us for a weekly Braves update. Carp, I appreciate you, man.
I appreciate you. We'll talk to you later.
All right. Thank you. We'll grab a break. Hey, by the way, T-Mac, did you know that the Titans altered their schedule for Monday because of the eclipse? I'm trying to figure out exactly. The sentence seems to contradict itself, but according to Mike Florio, it says via Terry McCormick of TitansInsider.com, the Titans have adjusted their Monday practice schedule to ensure the team won't be practicing when the total eclipse commences around 1:27. I actually did, Coach Mike Mularkey said, I adjusted the schedule so we will be practicing during it. I went back once we found out about it and rerouted the schedule so we're out here together to see it. Of course, Nashville is the largest city in the path of the total eclipse. I don't know what we're going to see, depending on where you're living and where you're listening to this thing. But I'm confused. Are they going to be there or are they not going to be there?
Mularkey makes it sound like they're going to watch it together on the field.
Yeah. I mean, did he mean like it would be the practice would be over? Or he said that they adjusted their practice schedule to ensure the team won't be practicing. And then it says, the Mularkey comment says, I adjusted it so we will be practicing, so we're out here together to see it. I don't know. That'll be weird.
Speaking of,
I mean, it happened in 1979, the last time it happened, a total eclipse like this.
Yeah, my mom was telling me about that yesterday. She called me to ask me if I was going to watch it, if I had any glasses, and how I need to, how important it is for me to watch it, because when she was a kid, she saw one and stuff like that. But
I don't know. I don't remember how much of a, it'll probably be cloudy. You know what I mean? It'll be cloudy. We won't even know the difference. I don't know. I haven't really spent much time thinking about it. I'll say this. When in 79, when the eclipse happened in 79, I was 18, 19 years old. And all I ever remembered was them saying about the way you look at it was by taking a piece of paper and poking a hole in the middle. And you look through it that way, through just a hole in the middle of the paper. They weren't in glasses and everything. But it wasn't nearly as much talk about it being so dangerous for like kids to look at it or whatever as there has been about this one. I mean, they've got schools that are closing and things like that. Is it really, I mean, can it really mess you up to just look up at the eclipse? I guess I don't get it.
I don't either.
Get why it's bad for you.
I was hoping you were going to be able to tell me that because I'm in the same boat. I have no idea. All I know is I'm getting glasses. My fiance's sister actually already got us a pair.
What kind of glasses do you got to wear?
They're eclipse glasses that a mall was giving away. There's malls all around Huntsville giving them out.
All right, so now but Huntsville's not in the, I'm closer to the center of it than Huntsville. Is Huntsville going to see the entire eclipse, or is it just going to be like a three-quarter eclipse? Because it's going straight over Nashville, and it's a width of like 50 miles. But from the path I've seen, you know, Huntsville's not in direct line. I don't know. It's 10 minutes before, it's a half an hour before we go on the show. I don't know. I'm not sure. All right, let's get a break. What I am sure about is David Moulton's coming up next. And we'll talk some college football with him right after this, 7:30, 103.9. Yep.
Wipe your paws. It's time to enter the doghouse.
Saturday on the SEC on CBS, when the CBS TV crew heads out, it's more than just Gary Danielson and the crew, and of course Vern Lundquist in the past, Brad Nessler now taking over It's a lot of support guys as well. And standing just off camera right alongside of Gary Danielson for the last several years has been my friend David Moulton. He also does radio for Sirius XM as well on a college sports nation. And he joins us now. Will be joining us throughout the season as well. David, welcome back. How are you, man?
I'm good, big dog. What's going on?
I am fantastic. And it occurs to me, too, because I was watching a little bit of that women's U.S. amateur. I know you do golf for Fox as well. But did you handle that? Were you out there for that deal?
I was not out there for the amateur. I do the three majors, the U.S. Right. Open, the Senior Open, and the Women's Open. I'm Joe Buck's right-hand guy, although I was not the guy who got Koepka's girlfriend's name wrong. I will. If I was, I'd own up to it, but otherwise I need to clear my good name.
Yeah, that's cool. We did talk about that last time. Before we get into some football talk, what was your sense on the re-racking of the schedule starting in 2019 with the PGA Championship moving to May and seeing that the Players now goes back to its original March date, which is a little sketchy sometimes weather-wise in Jacksonville, but that gives us, you know, March, April, May, June, July, FedEx Cup playoffs. Get out of the way. It's football season. What'd you think?
Well, I thought it was amazing to see a professional league completely surrender to football the way golf did. But it's smart when you think about it. I will say, as you mentioned, the Players will play completely differently in March to May. So if you're a big fan of golf, you may not recall what it was like 10 or so years ago. When that tournament was in March, it was usually a lot tougher and played a lot different than it has in May. The one thing about moving the PGA, Tom, from April to May is I think it opens up a lot more golf courses. It was tough for the PGA to come to the Southwest and to the Deep South with the tournament being in mid-August because it was just too damn hot. I think you move it to around the third weekend in May, which is what I think it's going to be. It opens up the whole South, and it opens up the Southwest as well. And we may get a nice variety of courses. Look how well Charlotte just worked out, Quail Hollow. That was a terrific tournament. I think this could be a boon for the PGA, plus second major as opposed to fourth. I think it'll be good for the PGA. The Players will be different, and it gives golf the best chance it can, because I don't know if you've noticed, but all three majors, the last three, had the exact same final round rating, a 3.6, and the Masters was the lowest rated since 2004. Golf audience has become a solid niche audience, and they've surrendered to it.
It's interesting because it was a little higher in these parts. The Mid-South numbers that come out of Nashville were in the mid fours for the final round, right about the same as the NASCAR races. Our NASCAR numbers have kind of held up a little bit as well, but it was interesting. Now you had an Alabama kid, you know, winning the thing, and that probably, you know, drove some of that number as well. But I think the South is ready for it still, and I'm with you. I think you open up a lot of great courses, and going from Jacksonville to Augusta, they could still stay in the region. We'll see how often they do that. And then, of course, the U.S. Open is always moving around as well. But it really helps the FedEx Cup. I think that's going to be the thing, because I'll watch FedEx Cup stuff at the end of July and into the beginning of the preseason with the NFL. Get it all over with. Get it out of the way.
And every 4 years when we have an Olympics, if golf's going to remain in it, we're not jamming in majors to in and around the Olympics. The Olympics can become a big event in and of itself. And, yeah, Tom, I wouldn't be surprised if that Labor Day weekend becomes maybe Tour Championship weekend, where the golf season ends on Labor Day.
Yeah. A couple of our golf insiders that we use, Matt Rudy and Stephen Gribben, both think that this also is going to open up another thing. The Ryder Cup is going to get out of late September and come into August, and they're going to get the Ryder Cup away from the NFL and college football as well. And I think that would be genius. I'd love to see the Ryder Cup in mid-August, you know, every other year.
Well, and who owns the Ryder Cup? The PGA of America. Yep. So in essence, they by moving their, you know, signature event, they then also bring in arguably their cash cow, the Ryder Cup, and, you know, it becomes a win-win for the PGA of America.
And I know you and I have both been NASCAR fans over the years and lament its continuing interest falling more and more. But I've been saying this for a number of years. You know, they got money issues. Teams are sizing down. Interest, is waning at different levels. Not enough of an off season. I say start that playoff at Daytona on the 4th of July weekend. Wrap that sucker up at Darlington at Labor Day weekend and go away for 5 months and watch the difference. Give these guys a real off season. Get this thing down to 26 total races, not 38. Get away from football in the fall as well, and you'd see a total different thing. I think the playoff should be from the Firecracker 400, if you will, to the Southern 500, and they should wrap it up at Darlington. How about that?
I think it's a great idea. However, name me the sport that has downsized its regular season, if you will.
Yeah. No,
I mean, you know, we've all advocated some of the best NBA and NHL regular seasons were strike or lockout shortened years. I mean, you know, the 50-game NBA regular season in 1999 was spectacular. Hockey had a lockout year one time where they had a 48-game regular season. Every game was tremendous. Every 2 points was extremely valuable. I don't think we're ever going to see it, Tom. Also, you know, NASCAR owns half the track. So they make money on every damn race, it seems, that they run. Tom, this may be an obscure point, and maybe I'm reaching here. You know what I think a big problem for NASCAR is? There's no angst. I talk about this in college football all the time. One of the reasons why it works, the rivalries, fans, it's year-long. The media also that covers college football is willing to dip their toes into issues that are going to honk people off. The NASCAR media, they're lapdogs. There's no angst. There's nobody criticizing anybody. There's nobody taking on anybody. There's nobody just flat out calling out and saying, so-and-so is not doing a good enough job driving. They need to be fired. This team needs to get rid of this guy. We don't have any of that in NASCAR. There's no angst. Angst creates interest. Interest creates ratings. The sport is too vanilla. It's too nice. Everyone's a great guy, and everybody's doing a great job. No, they're not. I'm telling you, I wish NASCAR was covered the way stick and ball sports are. I think it would help it.
Well, you know, and it's funny because when Kevin Harvick made his comments about Junior, I to a certain extent, and I'm a huge Earnhardt Family fan, but to a certain extent, I agreed in as much as this, the way Junior reacted. I mean, you know, the way he, can you imagine if somebody had said that about the old man? It would have been a fist fight. And Junior's reaction was milquetoast. His reaction was, well, I respect him. He won a lot of races for me. It was hurtful that he said that. This was the problem, that the guy who was carrying a banner was so nice. Now, I also said this, and I'm going to stick to this. I hope this doesn't turn into IRL. You know, I was a big fan of IRL. Open wheel racing, and that's my fear for NASCAR, is it's going to turn into IRL. But having said that, this whole thing, it's Teresa Earnhardt's fault. If Dale Jr. would have taken over DEI like he was supposed to, and the Earnhardt boys were running that thing, and he stayed in that number 8 car, had that Budweiser iconic sponsorship, and it was DEI that he was running for his dead daddy, it would have been a different thing. Teresa screwed this whole thing up. When he went to Hendrick, it was just milquetoast. How about that?
Well, and as Tony Stewart said at the time, DEI without Dale Earnhardt is a museum. And he was right.
He was right. David Moulton with us. All right, David, what am I missing here with your CBS schedule? Are you guys not doing a game opening weekend? I see that the September 9th game, you'll be at the TCU at Arkansas game. But are you guys not doing a game Labor Day weekend?
No, I think ESPN gobbled them all up. I think the only one that was even remotely possible with the television contracts to do was South Carolina, NC State. So, we're opening with TCU, Arkansas. Then it'll be Tennessee, Florida. And then, from there we'll see. I have a feeling we're going to be in Dallas for A&M and Arkansas, but who knows?
Yeah. Okay. I thought I thought maybe A&M at UCLA, but maybe that ended up on ESPN.
Since it's at UCLA, it's an we did it last year when it was at A&M, but since it's at UCLA, it's a ESPN ABC game.
Okay. By the way, Leonard Fournette and Derrick Henry both made some comments about the NFL and their early experience vis-a-vis the SEC, and that's all fine and dandy. I don't, you know, what they think about the speed of the game is irrelevant to me. But I am wondering about. I want to get your take on Leonard Fournette and what we might get out of him. Ezekiel Elliott burst on the scene, had a wonderful year last year, regardless of his off the field troubles. But I get this little inside me thing that keeps popping Trent Richardson's name into my head when I think of Leonard Fournette. What is the bust potential for Leonard Fournette with the Jacksonville Jaguars?
Well, if he can't stay healthy, which, you know, let's face it, at LSU, that was a
same
bit of a problem
injury
his last year. Mm-hmm. And now here he is. He has, you know, he's nicked up again early in Jacksonville camp. You know, I always worry about big backs, Tom. You know, it's tough for them to protect themselves and not be such a target and not take the pounding. You know, smaller backs seemingly can protect themselves, hide more, and what have you. I don't know about bust. I mean, man, he is talented. Man, is he talented. But you're right. So was Trent Richardson, who, quite frankly, looked like the better back at Alabama than the guy who won the Heisman Trophy.
Yeah.
So,
and
you know, I think if he stays healthy, it'll be tough for me to see him being a bust. All right. But, you know, the other thing that he's finding out in the NFL is that when you have competent quarterback play, there are less guys in the box, and it can be easier to run the ball. And even though he has Blake Bortles at quarterback, Blake Bortles in the NFL is still better than the quarterbacks he had at LSU.
No question. No question. And now there's question about Danny Etling at LSU and whether or not by the time you guys get your first look at LSU, which is usually fairly early, whether even Etling will be the starting quarterback there, because it seems to be that he's not grasping the whole thing that Dave Canada has brought to the table. And I don't know how long a leash Ed Orgeron has there, but if you're going to make the move, that's the time to do it in your first year. I don't think he has to worry about having a guy that can win 8 or 9 games for him. You might as well, if it's that close, geez, go with the young guy. And by your third year, you know, maybe you got a chance to win an SEC championship.
Well, Tom, Orgeron's thinking about September because first weekend in October he's at Florida, and second weekend in October he's hosting Auburn.
Right.
So he's got to get this quarterback situation figured out by late September, or else this season's going to go downhill really quickly. So, you know, I understand what you're thinking big picture. Ed Orgeron's big picture is BYU to open things up in Mississippi State week 3.
Yeah, you're probably right. David Moulton with us. All right, before I let you go, Chris Doering, a guy I like. I actually played a golf tournament with Chris Doering once in Naples, Florida, when I was down there. And I like and I respect Chris Doering, but he put a list out there on the SEC Network of the 4 most difficult places to play in the SEC. You've been to every stadium multiple times now in the SEC, and you sit there and you kind of get a sense of what it's like for the opponent team that is coming in. I like his number 1 at LSU. He had Tennessee at 2, and I guess you'd have to go back years to feel that, maybe back when he was playing, because I haven't felt that in recent years. Texas A&M at 3, and Cowbells at Mississippi State at 4. No Florida, no Tuscaloosa, no Auburn, no Georgia. What do you think of Chris Doering's list? LSU, Tennessee, Texas A&M, and Mississippi State.
Well, first off, I am wondering, did he ever play at Bryant-Denny? You know, it seems as if Alabama and Florida at that time was not a crossover regular season game. I thought it became a crossover later in the 90s. They just met for the SEC championship every year, so
right. That
was in Atlanta. You know, when he played in the Swamp, it was always a friendly environment, so he'll never think of the Swamp as a hostile environment. I will say, Tom, 12 years in the SEC, when I first started, all right, Tennessee, Knoxville was a hostile place. And now, obviously, you know, you're not as good. You go 5-7, 6-6, mm-hmm. It doesn't seem as hostile. But, yeah, I'm with you. Some of the stadiums that sit just a little bit lower also, sometimes it feels as if the fans are on you a little bit more. I would probably change a couple of those, but Baton Rouge at night is number 1 all time for me.
No, I agree with that. I mean, it's actually scary there at times. I mean, you know, the old thing with them, I mean, if they're beating you, They'll fight you in the stands too. If you're beating them, they'll fight amongst themselves. I mean, they're just going to fight. It's just, you know, that's going to happen. One of the very few places I haven't been in the league is Starkville and, Cowbells. I mean, I don't know. How bad is it?
Well, go back 3 years when Dak and the Bulldogs were 9-0 and number one in mid-November. They upset LSU early in the season on the road, but then they came home and they had A&M and Auburn back-to-back at home. And with the Cowbells, I've never seen a team affected during the daytime in an outdoor stadium as much as A&M and Auburn were affected by those Cowbells on beautiful, sunny, early October days the way they were by Mississippi State. It is, when they're good, it is hostile.
Yeah, no question. All right, David, I appreciate you. I'm looking forward to our conversations this year, and next week we'll have games to start breaking down, my man. I mean, it's happening. Everybody's focused on the second, but we got a number of games that are going to be played on the 26th, and we'll be able to take a closer look at the SEC as well next week. David Moulton has been our guest. David, appreciate you.
Tom, look forward to it every week.
All right, thank you. David Moulton, that's a good addition right there. That's solid, solid addition to the show right there. Let's get a break. We'll come back with our first update because we missed the first one. We'll do that right after this. It's the Tom Abraham Show. 730-1039. It's time to get our first look at the Doghouse Sports Report. We do that with Tony Mack.
The Atlanta Braves defeated the Colorado Rockies last night 4-3 behind Nick Markakis' seventh home run of the season. You can hear game three of that series tonight right here on The Ump. Coverage starts at 7:25. The Oakland Raiders get most bets to win the Super Bowl. That's right, the Raiders don't arrive in Vegas for a couple of years, but that hasn't stopped the city from betting on them. Their odds opened as high as 20-1 to win it all. Now their odds are down to 6-1 to win it all. That's second only to the defending champions at 3-1 in the New England Patriots. There are a lot more bets for the Raiders to win the AFC West than there are any other team in any other division. Former Ole Miss head coach Hugh Freeze called an escort service while on a recruiting trip. The call and visit took place in 2016 while Freeze was on a recruiting trip to Tampa, Florida. The escort service calls are related to Freeze's resignation from Ole Miss earlier this offseason. And Roger Goodell has appointed Harold Henderson. I can't pronounce a D anymore today. Harold Henderson as the arbiter to hear the Ezekiel Elliott's appeal. Henderson was the arbiter that heard the appeals of Greg Hardy and Adrian Peterson. Henderson upheld Peterson's suspension for child abuse and lowered Hardy's domestic violence suspension from 10 games to 4. I'm Tony Mack, and that is your Doghouse Sports Report.
All right, so we get updated there with T-Mac. Coming up at the top of the hour, Matt Scalise will join us from AL.com. We'll get into some Alabama and Auburn topics with him, including the defection, if you will, of John Franklin III to South Florida. Is there anything cryptic in that? Is it something where he just pretty much knew, saw the writing on the wall, and it was time for him to go? A very talented guy, a very athletic guy, but a guy that was maybe being told in the receiver room that he wasn't going to have the amount of touches that he hoped that he would have. You know, maybe that was the case. If you're an Auburn fan, you know, maybe this is something that bodes well. You know, maybe if a converted quarterback, senior type guy like that was your best option at wide receiver, maybe you got problems. Maybe the fact that John Franklin III really can't find a place on the field is something that tells you that, you know, they're building some kind of depth at that wide receiver spot. Don't know. All right, we'll get into that. We'll get into some Alabama as well. We'll do it all with Matt Scalise next, right here. on the Tom Abraham Show on 730-1039. Yeah.
Sports Radio 730 and 1039, The Ump.